season. We're very pleased to have Dr. J. Robert Vinoy, professor of Old Testament here at Biblical, speaking for us. He's going to be speaking on the subject of divine revelation and history in the Old Testament. Dr. Vinoy got a doctorate in Old Testament from the Free University of Amsterdam, where he did a thesis on covenant renewal at Gilgal. He's done the notes for 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, and the new NIV study Bible, which just came out. And he's preparing a commentary on 1 and 2 Samuel. We're happy to have him with us this evening to speak on divine revelation and history in the Old Testament.
Thank you, Bob. As I look over the group here, most of you sat in Old Testament history class in one year or another. Some of this material may sound somewhat familiar to you, but I think it's put perhaps in a little different way and form than you might have heard it before, so I hope it will be helpful to you. Divine revelation and history in the Old Testament is the subject. It does not require a great deal of reading or study of the Old Testament to become aware of the close connection that exists in Old Testament literature between divine revelation and history. Large sections of the Old Testament are in the form of historical narrative. In these narratives, God is represented as speaking and acting in human history. One, to make himself known, and two, to effectuate advances in the outworking of his plan of redemption. From beginning to end, the Bible depicts the redemption of man as something that God accomplishes by working within the context of ordinary human history. Adam and Eve fell into sin in the Garden of Eden through the temptation of Satan. Their sin resulted in alienation from God, from one another, and from the natural world around them. It brought death to them and their descendants. God, however, spoke and promised that the seed of the woman would be the means by which ultimate victory would be won over Satan and death itself, Genesis 3:15. The promise of this seed was the promise of Jesus, who, as we know from subsequent revelation, was God incarnate, being born of the Virgin Mary. Jesus lived, suffered, died, and rose from the dead in space-time history to redeem fallen humanity, to restore fellowship with God, and ultimately to restore all creation. The historical sections of the Old Testament depict the work of God in human history in bringing to fulfillment the promise of the coming of the seed of the woman. This promise, initially given to Adam, was renewed and amplified when God spoke to Abraham and said that in thy seed all nations of the earth will be blessed. Genesis 12:3. Abraham was also told that his descendants would become a great nation, that they would sojourn in a land not their own and be afflicted there 400 years, after which God would deliver them and bring them into the land of Canaan, which he had already promised to give to Abraham and his descendants for their homeland. Subsequent Old Testament historical narratives show how God did indeed deliver the descendants of Abraham from Egypt, under the leadership of Moses and Aaron, by many miraculous signs and wonders, and how he entered into covenant with them at Mount Sinai, where he spoke and gave his law amidst the thunderings and lightnings that enveloped the mountain. After suffering 40 years of wilderness journeys because of disobedience, Israel was brought into the land of promise. The history of Israel in the land is, for the most part, a history of continual apostasy and turning away from the Lord, with some few exceptions of times of revival and reformation. But at the same time, it is a history in which the Lord's long-suffering and covenant faithfulness are repeatedly manifested. In due time, God placed David on the throne as an imperfect but true representative of the ideal of the covenantal king. David is given the promise that his dynasty will endure forever. And in this promise, the line of the promised seed is narrowed to the house of David within the tribe of Judah. After Israel's continual disobedience led her to be being driven from the land, even though a small remnant was eventually able to return, the promised seed came in the person of Jesus, born of Mary and in the line of Abraham and David. This, in an extremely abbreviated form, is the history of redemption depicted in the Old Testament scriptures. In this history, God repeatedly speaks to make his will known. At times appears to men in visible form, and at other times demonstrates his power and sovereignty over nature and history through miraculous signs and wonders to advance his redemptive purposes. In this resume of redemptive history, as contained in the Old Testament, there are some things of particular importance for our topic, divine revelation and history in the Old Testament, to which we should give our attention. Revelation in the Old Testament often takes the form of communication from God to man ab extra. On various occasions, God spoke to certain individuals in an audible voice perceived by normal sense perception. In such instances, revelation is objective and as real as our own verbal communication with each other. It should be noted that not all divine revelation is given in this way, but some is, and this is important. In his book on biblical theology, Gerhardus Voss points out that there is also what may be termed subjective revelation, which is, to quote Voss, the inward activity of the Spirit upon the depths of human subconsciousness, causing certain God-intended thoughts to well up therefrom. The Psalms offer examples of this kind of revelation. And although brought up in a subjective channel, we nonetheless must claim for it absolute divine authority. Otherwise, it could not properly be called revelation. In this subjective form, revelation and inspiration coalesce. End of quote from Voss. Voss's next statement, however, is important. He says we must be on our guard against the modern tendency to reduce all revelation in the scriptures to this category of the ab intra compared to the ab extra. That is usually intended to deprive revelation of its infallibility. A favorite form is to confine revelation proper to the bare acts of self-disclosure performed by God, and then to derive the entire thought content of the Bible from human reflection upon these acts. End of quote from Voss. This is indeed a modern tendency, perhaps even more pronounced today than when Voss wrote his biblical theology. Although revelation is not to be confined to the bare acts of divine self-disclosure, such acts did occur and may in themselves have revelatory significance. Because revelation is closely connected with the history of redemption, in a number of instances, revelation becomes identified with history. Or to use Voss's expression, it becomes incarnate in history. To put it a bit differently, we might say that besides using words, God also employed acts to reveal great principles of truth. What Voss has in mind here is not just prophetic visions or miracles, but the great outstanding acts of redemption, such as the deliverance of the Israelites out of Egypt, and in the New Testament, the crucifixion and resurrection of Christ. In such instances, history itself is revelatory. There is in such acts themselves, as Voss suggests, a self-disclosure of God. This means that there are instances where act revelation must be considered in addition to word revelation. It should be noted, however, that this emphasis on revelation through act or event is rightly qualified by Voss in a twofold manner. First, when revelation and redemptive acts of God coincide, the primary purpose of such acts is not revelation, even though this is an important and essential aspect of their purpose. Voss says, quote, primarily, they possess a purpose that transcends revelation. having a Godward reference in their effect, and only in dependence on this, a manward reference for instruction. End of quote. Thus, for example, the crucifixion and resurrection of Christ primarily serve a purpose in reference to God, to satisfy divine justice, so that it would not be proper to view these acts exclusively or even primarily under their function with respect to revelation. Yet, Voss holds that the revealing element in such acts is essential, the two ends of satisfaction and revelation being combined into one. Second qualification. Second way in which Voss qualifies his emphasis on revelation through act or event is to point out that such act revelations are never left entirely to speak for themselves. He emphasizes that the revelatory acts of God never appear separated from his verbal communications of truth. Word and act always accompany each other, usually with the act preceded and followed by word revelation. Voss comments, quote, "To apply the Kantian phraseology to a higher subject, without God's acts, the words would be empty. Without his words, his acts would be blind." End of quote. A look at Exodus 1 to 12 in this connection is very instructive. Here, the word of God consistently comes first. The deed of God follows. It's an interesting thing to trace through Exodus 1 to 12. Revelation is not contained in a word which arises simply by interpretation from a deed. Revelation in these narratives consists initially in a word which is then subsequently confirmed by a deed. The words and deeds of God are joined together in a snug system of confirmatory revelation, whereby God commits himself verbally to what he proposes to do, and then confirms that as a veracious word by doing precisely what he said he would do. Those of the revelation and history school of approach to the Old Testament, who would limit divine revelation to the medium of event, and there are many such around, do not take sufficiently into account the important role of word revelation, which in fact is indispensable for divine revelation in history to be perceptible with any degree of certainty and clarity. There's perhaps no issue in contemporary biblical and theological studies that is more important than a correct understanding of the relation between divine revelation and history, or to look at the same issue from another perspective, the relation between faith, which is the human response to divine revelation, and history. During the time of the Enlightenment, or Age of Reason, serious questions were raised about the biblical representations of God's speaking and acting in human history. The scientific and intellectual developments of this time fostered belief in natural law and confidence in human reason. A rational and scientific approach to religious, social, and political issues promoted a secular view of the world. This intellectual climate spawned a new approach for the study of the Bible as well. It was characterized by at least three important and interrelated developments. One, there was a strong reaction against any form of supernaturalism. The idea was that reason, not revelation, was the source of all truth. This destroyed the authority of the Bible as divine revelation. Moral norms were not sought in God's law, but in human reason and conscience. Two, there was the development of a new hermeneutic, namely the historical critical method. Those who utilized this method viewed history as a closed continuum, an unbroken series of causes and effects in which there is no room for supernatural interventions. As Gerhard Hassel summarizes the approach, all, quote, historical events must be capable of being explained by antecedent historical causes and understood in terms of analogy to other historical experiences, end of quote. That principle of historical analogy is extremely influential. When these criteria are not met, then according to this hermeneutic, one can be certain that the event or phenomena being considered did not happen in the way it is depicted as having occurred. Then thirdly, you have this reaction against supernaturalism, development of the historical critical method. Thirdly, there was the development of radical literary criticism of the Bible. Gene Astrup, 1654 to 1766, a French physician, published a work in 1753 in which he proposed that the book of Genesis was to a great extent a composite of J and E sources that gave alternate versions of the same stories. He also found numerous other sources in Genesis of less significance. He did not deny Mosaic authorship to Genesis in the sense that he considered Moses to be the one who combined the sources. But his theory of distinguishing sources on the basis of different names for God provided a foundation on which later Pentateuchal criticism would build, and the now long and complex history of the development of critical theories of the composition of biblical books was begun. Under the influence of these ideas, the descriptions of God speaking and acting in human history, in the way described in the biblical narratives, came to be regarded as something that did not actually happen. The orthodox view of the Bible was thus gradually weakened and ultimately abandoned by many. Rejection of biblical supernaturalism and objective divine revelation by word and act left the practitioners of biblical studies who utilized these methods with serious and insoluble problems. The nature of some of these problems can be seen by means of a brief survey of trends in Old Testament studies over the past century. I will attempt to sketch some of these trends by means of a very brief survey of the views of three men who, in my opinion, have been the most influential scholars in the area of Old Testament criticism in the past century. These three men are Julius Wellhausen, 1844 to 1918, Hermann Gunkel, 1862 to 1932, and Gerhard von Rad, 1901 to 1971. First, Julius Wellhausen, 1844 to 1918. Julius Wellhausen wedded a documentary source theory of the origin of the Pentateuch to an evolutionary idea of the development of Israel's religious beliefs. Wellhausen believed all religions developed in an evolutionary pattern from polytheism to henotheism to monotheism, or to use another scheme, from natural religion represented in the J.E. sources to prophetic religion, the D source, to priestly religion, the P source. He then used the JEDP sources, which he had isolated in the Pentateuch, to demonstrate this development in Israel by assigning dates to the sources that reflected this alleged development. In the process, he said ideas from later times were projected into earlier periods by the writers of the Old Testament. And he not only denied the reliability of many historical sections of the Old Testament, but went further to claim that it included many deliberate fabrications. This approach, of course, was not without consequences for the message of the Old Testament. The major concern of Wellhausen and his followers, however, ceased to be the message of the Old Testament or its meaning for us today. But rather, the interest was in the reconstruction by means of the historical critical method of what was considered to be the history of Israel's religious development based on an evolutionary presupposition. Wellhausen himself resigned from his professorship on the theological faculty at Greifswald because he did not feel adequate to prepare students for service in the Protestant church. It was a matter of conscience with him. Unfortunately, many of his students did not follow his example with respect to their professorship. Secondly, Hermann Gunkel, 1862 to 1932. Although Hermann Gunkel did not abandon the source documents of Wellhausen, his interest lay elsewhere. He directed his attention, for the most part, to what he viewed as the antecedent oral traditions that lay behind Wellhausen's documents. In doing this, he developed what has come to be known as form criticism, compared to the literary criticism of the Wellhausen school. In his approach, he isolated story units, attempted to determine their literary genre or Gattung, and then the situation in life, the Sitzenleben, that originally produced the form in question. According to Gunkel's analysis, most of the narratives of Genesis are to be viewed as legends of various kinds. It's right at this point, however, that a significant difference between Gunkel and Wellhausen becomes apparent. Even though Gunkel viewed the stories of Genesis as legend and not history, he felt that he was still able to preserve their religious value and meaning, because, in his view, what actually happened is not the important thing in the legend, but the message conveyed by the story is the significant thing. He says, for example, quote, "Think of the force with which in the Cain story murder is set forth as the basal crime, the charm of the Joseph story, the eloquent of fraternal envy and fraternal love, and full of faith in an overruling providence," end of quote. So even though Gunkel abandoned the historical value of the Old Testament, he tried to hold on to its religious moral value. This represents a reaction against the sterile theological attitude generated by the Wellhausen school, in which the religious value of the Old Testament was swallowed up by a purely literary and history of religions approach. But notice that having abandoned the supernaturalism and objectivity of divine revelation in the Old Testament materials, Gunkel begins to move toward a divided field of knowledge in biblical studies, in which historical truth is separated from religious truth. Third figure is Gerhard von Rad, 1901 to 1971. Hermann Gunkel's form critical method had great influence on Gerhard von Rad of the University of Heidelberg. Developing his own unique approach to the formation of the Hexateuch in the historical books of the Old Testament, von Rad wrote a major two-volume theology of the Old Testament and a number of commentaries, including one on Genesis and one on Deuteronomy. His work is still highly regarded, and he would certainly have to be considered one of the most influential Old Testament scholars of the 20th century. The details of his approach to divine revelation and history would take far too long to review in this lecture. But the thing that von Rad did, which is of particular significance for our own discussion, was to give the divided field of knowledge already discernible in Gunkel's thought much greater visibility and clarity. Von Rad distinguished between two sorts of history of Israel. For one form, he uses the German term Historie, which has reference to modern scientific historiography and deals with history in the sense of what actually occurred. But according to von Rad, this Historie can no longer be established from the biblical source materials. The biblical narratives, in his view, do not give us Historie, but rather they give us Heilsgeschichte, which is his second term, which is a history that is the construct and expression of Israel's faith. The Heilsgeschichte is, to use his own terminology, confessional history. It's a history that's confessed. It's a history in which Israel expresses something of how she understood her own relationship with God. For von Rad, the history of Israel in the sense of what happened, and the history of Israel as formed by Israel's faith, are two very different matters. Von Rad is concerned only with the latter. He says in his theology of the Old Testament, quote, "These two pictures of Israel's history lie before us, that of modern critical scholarship and that which the faith of Israel constructed, namely the Old Testament. And for the present, we must reconcile ourselves to both of them The one is rational and objective. That is, with the aid of historical method and presupposing the similarity of all historical occurrence, that's the principle of analogy again, it constructs a critical picture of the history as it really was in Israel. The other activity is confessional and personally involved in the events to the point of fervor. The fact that these two views of Israel's history are so divergent is one of the most serious burdens imposed today upon biblical scholarship. So he seems to feel the weight of the problem himself. Von Rad really has no solution for this problem. He opts, however, to utilize the Heilsgeschichte, or the confessional history, for his own theological reflection, rather than the history, namely what actually happened. The radical dualism in von Rad's system is, however, a stumbling block, not only for those who take the historical trustworthiness of the Old Testament seriously, but even for many who have accepted the historical critical method. Franz Hesse, himself an advocate of the historical critical method, says in criticism of von Rad, "Our faith lives from what happened in Old Testament times, and not from that which is confessed to have happened. Our faith needs to rest upon that which has actually happened, and not that which is confessed to have happened, but about which we have to admit that it did not happen in that way." That's Franz Hesse. Now, certainly, Hesse is correct in insisting that faith must rest on what has happened. But, as an advocate of the historical critical method, he too is forced, by means of his method, to remove supernaturalism from the pages of the historical narratives of the Old Testament. His view is that the only history which has theological relevance is the history reconstructed by the historical critical method. This is then a history that is robbed of objective divine speaking and acting in human history. In spite of the many variations in approach between Dunkel, von Rad, Hesse, and a host of others, it remains the case that all who adopt the historical critical method ultimately are forced into some form of humanistic religious subjectivism, because they have rejected a priori the possibility of objective divine revelation in word and act. There is hardly a more important issue facing the world of biblical studies today than this issue. As Gerhard Hassel points out, the historical critical method requires that, quote, historical events must be capable of being explained by antecedent historical causes and understood in terms of analogy to other historical experiences. The method which prides itself of its scientific nature and objectivity turns out to be in the grip of its own dogmatic presuppositions and philosophical premises about the nature of history. A biblical theology which rests upon a view of history that is based on an unbroken continuum of causes and effects cannot do justice to the biblical view of history and revelation, nor to the scriptures' claim to truth. What needs to be emphatically stressed is that there is a transcendent or divine dimension in biblical history which the historical critical method is unable to deal with. If all historical events must, by definition, be explained by sufficient historical causes, then there is no room for the acts of God in history, for God is not a historical character. If one's view of history is such that one cannot acknowledge a divine intervention in history through deed and word, then one is unable to deal adequately and properly with the testimony of Scripture. We are therefore led to conclude that the crisis respecting history in biblical theology is not so much a result of the scientific study of the evidences, but stems from the historical critical method's inadequacy to deal with the role of transcendence in history due to its philosophical presuppositions about the nature of history. Now, that was all a quote from Hassel. But I think he has really put his finger on the issue. The God of the Bible is a God who has spoken and acted in human history to provide for the redemption of fallen man. Whenever and by whatever means God's speaking and acting in human history are denied, then inevitably the Bible's message of redemption is destroyed. The Bible unites divine revelation, redemption, and human history in such a way that any tampering with the objective historical reality of divine revelation inevitably eviscerates the Bible's message of redemption. It is for this reason that it is so necessary for evangelical scholarship to vigorously maintain the importance of the historical trustworthiness of the Bible. The history of the Bible is the history of redemption. Unfortunately, we find that some who consider themselves to be within the evangelical community have made significant concessions to the historical critical method and have even moved toward accepting a divided field of knowledge in biblical studies, separating religious truth from historical truth, which I might say is unavoidable when one tries to fuse the historical critical method with traditional biblical teaching. A certain result of such a position, however, will be increasing erosion of confidence in biblical historicity and a consequent loss of authenticity and authority for the Bible's message of redemption. As J. Gresham Machen said in his inaugural address as assistant professor of New Testament literature and exegesis at Princeton Seminary on May 3, 1915, quote, "The separation of Christianity from history has been a great concern of modern theology. It has been an inspiring attempt, but it has been a failure. Give up history and you can retain some things. You can retain belief in God, but philosophical theism has never been a powerful force in the world. You can retain a lofty ethical ideal, but be perfectly clear about one point. You can never retain a gospel. For gospel means good news, tidings, information about something that has happened. In other words, it means history. A gospel independent of history is simply a contradiction in terms." End of quote. Praise be to God who has spoken and acted in history to provide for our redemption, and who has given us a trustworthy record of what he has done in the scriptures of the Old and the New Testament. That's the end of my paper. I don't know if some of you have some questions.
It seems to me if you try to chart out a biblical position and then the position of Wellhausen, Dunkel, and von Rad with respect to the question of the religious value of the Old Testament. From a biblical perspective, I think we would say religious value is in the relationship established between God and his people. This relationship is constituted in the interplay of revelation by word and deed, speaking and acting, and faith. And I've attempted to indicate that here. Here's history in this bottom line. What happened? It's recorded in the Old Testament and New Testament. God on the top line. God speaks, the arrow comes down, man responds in faith. But you have God who acts in history and speaks in history, and man responds to that revelation. And the relationship then is established between God and man, and the religious value, particularly the Old Testament, is to be found in that interaction between God and man and revelation through word and event. Now, when you look at Wellhausen, that whole structure is gone because the basis for faith and revelation are gone. And the religious value is destroyed, and he's really not interested in that. His interest is in the history of the evolution of Israel's religious beliefs and practices. And it's a history of religion sort of approach, and that's the interest. So religious value is really not an issue with Wellhausen. When you come to Dunkel, I think you have something like this. With Dunkel, the stories of the Old Testament are poetic expressions of the people and contain great religious ideas. The stories are filtered through a screen of time and transformation. History, I have a broken line here, in the sense of what happened, is hard to detect in the written traditions, which would be the Old Testament. History, in the sense of what happened, is really not important anyway. The message of the stories is. So you have a sort of broken line here as far as what actually happened. It's hard to reconstruct. It's hard to get back to it. But you have these stories filtered through this screen of time and transformation. And it's this upper line up here where you get religious meaning that is a significant thing anyway, not so much what has happened. But you begin to get into this area of a divided field of knowledge. It's not fully worked out. I mean, the lines aren't fully drawn. But when you get to Von Rath, I think you have something like this. You have this solid line here. You have two disciplines to be kept separate as two parallel lines. They don't really have anything to do with each other. Above this line, you have the Heils Geschichte, or the salvation history, the confessional history. Israel's unique religious genius expressed in her faith is what produces that history. So faith is what creates the history. So here's faith, creates this line here, which is the history, the Heils Geschichte. And that's really what we have in the Old Testament. Below this line, history, in the sense of what happened, little or nothing can be known. And Von Rad's really not interested in that. So he just leaves that history pretty much alone. Works with this confessional history as we have it, but you've got that divided field of knowledge, and it's quite rigid with Von Rad. So it seems to me that that's the way things have moved from Wellhausen-Dunkel to Von Rad, and to a large extent, that's where we are today, although it's hard to make generalizations about a whole field of thought, but certainly Von Rad is very, very influential. This book that came out, well, I guess it's almost 10 years ago now, so it's comparatively recent in the field, by T.L. Thompson on the patriarchal traditions, it really works with this structure. And the book has had a fair amount of influence. Okay, any questions, comments? Yes?
So in your diagrams up there, if I understand it, the song of lines that we have up there, like in Von Rad, that is what we have passed down to us today, and so we have a firm grasp on the Heils Geschichte, versus in the history, we do not have a firm grasp. So what you're showing is on the solid lines, that's where we have a firm grasp today.
Well,
so with Dunkel versus the dotted lines, where
yeah,
we don't have
yeah.
firm grasp.
All right. This line here, this Heils Geschichte, which is produced by Israel's faith, is something. The line here would represent really the historical material of the Old Testament. That was produced over a long period of time and re-transformed, modified in the course of time as Israel attempted to express her faith in the form of historical narratives. But we have that, yeah. You read the Old Testament, you get that. Down here, history in the sense of what happened, you would have to somehow penetrate behind that material you have in the Old Testament and separate out what is really historical from what isn't. Von Rad really doesn't think there's much way you can do that. And he would actually say that there's really not much possibility to get back to what actually happened. But he's not really much interested in that, so he doesn't pay much attention to it.
And so with Dunkel, though, he says there is some filtration between the two, though it's through a filter system or colored glasses that you see it.
Yeah. He would say the story, see the line up here again is the Old Testament as we have it. But these stories are filtered through a screen of time and transformation. So again, you see, to get back to what happened down to that dotted line, it's hard.
But with Dunkel, he seems like you have a little bit better.
The lines are sharper and clearer with Dunkel. With Von Rad, the lines are sharper and clearer in the sense that these two histories are kept totally separate.
So, Dunkel, the faith history has some sort of meaning based on what will happen.
Well, yeah, to some extent. But he's really, he's not as interested in what really happened as he is in the message and the religious ideas that the stories contain. So it's also moving toward that divided field of knowledge.
I was saying that when I was in the Netherlands, and I, some of my parents' friends were there, they'd gone into, I guess, a government type of philosophy where they had talked about, well, we also have some good religious stories, morality, some Christos from India, and attitudes like that. We have more than one type of Christos that was talking about that attitude, that just the religious, I guess, message was important no matter
Hindu or whatever. Yeah. See, that's once you've eliminated this objective divine revelation of God speaking and acting, then what do you have left but subjective human ideas about religious things? And insights then would be accepted from almost any source as having some sort of validity.
The distinction of being able, if you do that, then you lose your capability to say that Christianity is separate from
Judaism.
Yeah. I don't know if this is off the track or not, but to me, one of the dilemmas that I face sometimes in reading the Old Testament stories is not so much the question of whether it is recorded history, but which of the recorded history is narrating things that are approved of God, and which ones are just narrating things because it's factual and accurate, etc., etc. But not necessarily saying God approved this. To me, that's the big dilemma. I don't know whether that's going to fall into the same kind of category or not.
Right? I don't.
I have gone through some of those things that are discussed in the Old Testament, whether God really approved of those actions or whether he simply recorded what was being done.
Well, I think it's quite a different issue from this. I think in many instances, you'll find that there are things that God is working in spite of what is happening and going on. And you take all the Joseph narrative. Certainly the fact that Joseph was sold into Egypt by his brothers is not something that God puts a stamp of approval on. But you meant it for evil, I meant it for good. I think there are a lot of stories in the Old Testament that you find that kind of a thread in. Some of them are maybe, particularly the period of the judges, you find a lot of things that the judges did, whether Samson or Jephthah, and you wonder, these were men upon whom the Spirit came, they're deliverers, they've been raised up by God, yet they're doing a lot of things that don't seem to be compatible with biblical teaching and divine revelation elsewhere. How do you explain that? I think there are things that actually happened. I think God was working in spite of human sin and weakness and frailty, and through all that bringing glory to himself, but not necessarily sanctioning everything that these men did. And not everything that these men did are to be understood as examples for us or anything. But I think you have to sort that out on the basis of biblical teaching elsewhere, because a lot of times in the narratives, there's no evaluation or comment made.
In taking a step to the New Testament, if we were to make a statement, if one were to make a statement, we do not, or we cannot know exactly what Christ said, but because he probably didn't speak Greek, God spoke Aramaic. I'm saying, even hypothetically, what Jesus said. Therefore, you have to take a compilation of what each of the evangelists wrote, and then you get the basic message of what he's saying. To me, that sounds very, very close to, or it sounds like a tremendous shift toward Gunkel's approach, though I'm using it in a New Testament context. I prefer Dr. Newman's approach of saying that the different accounts are an itinerant speaker at different occasions and so on, but recently I was in a discussion with a scholar who made that comparison to me, and in my mind, that shows a tremendous shift that says you're getting very close to the Gunkel line of thinking there. You have to filter through everything to get back, and the main thing is the message, because we really can't know exactly what they say. I'm wrestling with that.
Well,
and of course, understanding the historical critical method of the Old Testament, I'm trying to contextualize that to that circumstance.
I don't know, it seems to me, I'm not all that familiar with the details of working out all the problems in the synoptics with some of those questions, but I think that in principle, you have the issue of historiography. Anybody who's going to sit down and write a history of a particular period or a particular individual, his acts, or his, what he said, or what he did, and so forth, anybody who sits down and does that has to come to his task with certain criteria for selection of his material, certain principles for organizing material, certain principles for deciding what's important, what is important, what it's going to include, what it's going to leave out, et cetera, et cetera. And every piece of historical writing has that aspect to it. Now, I think what we would say is that when the biblical writers act as historians, they also had those criteria, selective criteria that were functioning, and there's involved in that a certain element of interpretation and analysis of the material. What they put down is subject to that, inevitably, it has to be. But I think what we would say is that whatever they said, we can be sure it happened. Which is quite different from Dunkel. In other words, I think we can say, to get back in the Old Testament where I'm a bit more familiar, I think we can say with the historical section of the Old Testament that there is a religious pragmatic to that historical material. There's a theological assessment of things in the composition of that material. But that is not to say that the things that they put down didn't happen. And with Dunkel, that he is saying that. I think what we would say is where an interpretation becomes part of the biblical record in the course of the composition of biblical material, that interpretation is an interpretation sanctioned by the work of the Holy Spirit. It's a correct interpretation.
Right. To take a specific line of development in the Old Testament, Abraham came into the land and set up an altar to cure the oaks of Moab, and he went over Bethlehem. Those are historically religious shrines connected to the historical land. I don't disbelieve that
he
did that.
Yeah.
Nonetheless, the woman of Samaritan woman said, our father said that something about Gerizim and that era or something, and the oaks of Moreh and so on. You can easily see how people studying the religious history of the Old Testament would latch onto the fact that there was a lot of religious activity in a pagan sense, probably, going on around Gerizim or in the area of Shechem and so forth and so on, Bethel. And the fact that Abraham set up these altars at this place, you can easily see where the implication would be that either he was participating in this pagan practice or that somebody was reading after the fact that, well, the way the thing started was Abraham. Put the altar here, and that's why it was a shrine. I'm not saying I believe the political report there. I guess one of the things that bothers me, I think we sound like I'm heavy here for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that bothers me is I think evangelicals sometimes are definitely afraid of even discussing the religious contemporary history around in that era, for fear of making it sound like Abraham or Samuel or some of these other people were participating in what ultimately became shrines or pagan sites. I think that Shechem became a pagan site after the time of Samuel,
after the ark was moved to Jerusalem, and Jerusalem was selected as the site for the Deuteronomy, still, there was a lot of worship going on in Shechem and Bethel, and these sites, which originally were set up by Abraham, let's say, continued on as pagan sites.
Well, not just as pagan sites. In the end of Joshua, Joshua calls in Joshua 24 all Israel to Shechem to renew the covenant. Samuel went to Bethel. So, there is a tradition of legitimate worship being carried on at those sites, which were recognized as important sanctuaries, traced back to the fathers, particularly Abraham. So that, I think within the legitimate worship of Israel, there was room for worship at a lot of sites other than simply the temple on the hillside. There's been a tradition, particularly among evangelicals, that Deuteronomy 12 required centralization at Jerusalem, no sacrifice, no worship legitimate elsewhere outside of Jerusalem. I'm not inclined to think that's the proper interpretation of Deuteronomy 12, and I think that there were legitimate altars apart from the Jerusalem altar. There was a primacy to Jerusalem. The annual feasts were held there, but it seems to me that legitimate worship could be found at numerous other sites as long as certain prescribed regulations, as in Exodus 23, is it, or 23, somewhere in there, where the wall of the altar, where it tells what kind of an altar should be constructed.
So you don't interpret the idea that single site as meaning that was the only
place? No, absolutely not.
You take it the same way as the Deuteronomy 18 passage, don't you, with the, you have pictured there, a prophet. Sort of the idea, a prophet will come along now and then. And so here, God has appeared at this site, and at that site, and at that site, in worship at sites where he's appeared.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, it says, let me get that passage in Exodus. Exodus 20:24. An altar of earth shalt thou make unto me, thou shalt sacrifice thereon thy burnt offerings, thy peace offerings, thy sheep and thine oxen, in all places where I record my name. I will come unto thee and I will bless thee. And if thou wilt make me an altar of stone, thou shalt not build it with hewn stone, for if thou lift up thy tool upon it, thou shalt pollute it, neither shalt go up thy steps in mine altar, that thy nakedness not be exposed thereon. It seems that the Israelite altar was to be distinct from the Canaanite altar, but that such altars could be built in all places where I record my name. Now, what does that mean? In all places where I record my name. Perhaps. Pardon?
And how is that affected by Deuteronomy?
Well, you see, in the Deuteronomy 12 passage, you have the statement in verse 5, and then on down, you have it in verse 11 and 13. 5. Unto the place which the Lord shall choose out of all your tribes, put his name there. Even unto his habitation you shall seek, and there thou shalt come. Verse 11, then there shall be a place which the Lord your God shall choose to cause his name to dwell there. There ye shall bring all I command you. Verse 13, take heed to thyself, thou not offer thy burnt offerings in every place that thou seest, but in the place which the Lord shall choose in one of thy tribes. That's probably the strongest one. The place which the Lord shall choose in one of thy tribes. Now that gets into an analysis of the Hebrew there and comparison of the use of that kind of a construction in some other places. But you can read that, even though it's singular, in any place which the Lord shall choose in any of your tribes. And I think good cases have been made to read it that way, that the intent is not to limit legitimate altar to one single place in one of the tribes.
One type of place where God has called it.
Yeah, which is consistent with the Exodus 20:24. Now that you see the Wellhausen school or the documentary source kind of school will say what you have in Exodus 20 is a JE code, covenant code, law code, which allows multiplicity of altars. The Deuteronomy 12 is the D code, the
Deuteronomy Code coming out from the time of Josiah, which was a document that was influenced by the people in Jerusalem, prophets, priests perhaps, who wanted to centralize worship for what kind of power that could give them. And Wellhausen interpreted Deuteronomy 12 as requiring centralization of worship, as sort of a cornerstone of his whole theory. This move from multiplicity of altars to central altar in this development, evolutionary development of Israel's religion. Now, I think the emphasis of Deuteronomy 12 is purity of worship, but not centralization of worship. There was to be primacy of place to Jerusalem, but not exclusive rights to worship.
How do you interpret the occasion, I think it's in Joshua, where one of the tribes set up an altar at the Jordan River and tried to bring out massacres for doing that until they explained that it was something immoral or something like that.
Well, I would take it as an altar that had not met all these requirements. The Lord had not designated that that was a place where an altar could be built. He had not caused his name to dwell there.
No,
just arbitrarily saying, I'm going to go out and build. Couldn't just arbitrarily go out and put an altar anywhere.
It seems that before we get to Jerusalem, we have Samuel going to various places and emphasis is put on that. After Jerusalem, though, the only other place that I'm familiar with is when we make the sacrifice is Elijah and Mount Carmel, and that could be illustrative. But the just very absence of people going around and making sacrifices in various other places, and yet the king still has many different kinds of altars and high places.
Yeah.
You can understand when we get the idea that the fulfillment of the one place really is Jerusalem, and the other might be some kind of a temporary injunction.
You know, Elijah, too, he not only builds the altar, but he complains that all these altars of the Lord have been torn down, as if that was something that should not have been done. Yeah.
But the fact that he's in the north had anything to do with it. That at least if these people weren't going to come down to Jerusalem, at least they would have had some place to worship the whole bunch of And I'm always struck with the kings who were strong and when they were powerful and not only beating down altars in Judah, but even...
Yeah, but I think most of the references to that are these high places, which seems to have been Israelite taking over, you know, as Mr. Foster was indicating, taking over heathen worship sites and utilizing them for the worship of the Lord in some kind of syncretistic kind of form, which quickly led to apostasy. And certainly that was something that I don't think was ever permitted. However, high places per se, I don't think were illegitimate. It is the kind of high place where this kind of syncretistic worship went on. There's, I thought I brought my new NIV text with me. I don't have it. I think there's some notes there. I'm not sure I can find them on this issue. But, in 1 Kings 3:2, you read of Solomon. The people, however, were still sacrificing at the high places because the temple had not yet been built for the name of the Lord. Of course, Solomon himself sacrificed at high places. But there's a note there in this NIV study Bible. It says this on high places. Upon entering Canaan, the Israelites often followed the Canaanite custom of locating their altars on high hills, probably on the old Baal sites. The question of the legitimacy of Israelite worship at these high places has long been a matter of debate. It is clear that the Israelites were forbidden to take over pagan altars and high places and use them for the worship of the Lord. A number of references there. It is also clear that altars were to be built only at divine sanctioned sites. Divinely sanctioned sites. See Exodus 20:24, Deuteronomy 12:5, 8:13, 14. It is not so clear whether multiplicity of altars was totally forbidden, provided the above conditions were met, and a number of references. It seems, however, that these conditions were not followed, even in the time of Solomon, and pagan high places were being used for the worship of the Lord. This would eventually lead to religious apostasy and syncretism, was strongly condemned. Well, there's another sentence there, but I think that's the essence of it. There are references where it seems that high places were not per se condemned. One of the kings, I can't think which one it is offhand. In Chronicles, it says he tore down the high places. In Kings, it says he didn't tear down any of the high places, which is an interesting one of these places where it appears you might have some kind of contradiction in parallel accounts. My own conclusion on that, and I've forgotten where that is precisely, my own conclusion is that he tore down these syncretistic high places. He didn't tear down the high places which were legitimate.
There's one other phrase that comes to my mind where it says that people continue to sacrifice the high places, but only to the Lord.
Okay.
And it doesn't seem to be said in a way that's just favorable. But that, again, we do interpret that as meaning that they were really Canaanite altars, but they were at least sacrificing to the Lord.
No, not necessarily. It seems to me that it could have simply been an altar on a high hill, an Israelite altar, not necessarily a Canaanite shrine originally. You know, when Samuel, in 1 Samuel 9, I guess, when Saul comes looking for information from him, he takes him up to a high place for sacrifice.
That's still before the temple.
That's right. That's still before the temple.
Isn't there one actually even set up at all?
Yeah, well, I think that was a political act as much as anything else. He didn't want to, he wanted to maintain political power over the people in the north. He didn't want them going down to Jerusalem, so he set up those altars, and with the golden calves, it was certainly illegitimate. But I'm not convinced that it was illegitimate to sacrifice at any place other than Jerusalem. I mean, there were a lot of sacrifices that were to be offered, not just on occasions of the annual festivals. What was the Israelites to do who lived in Dan? That's a long journey to go to Jerusalem every time you wanted to offer a sacrifice.
But it seems like there's a provision for that where he could sell what he was going to sacrifice, take the money, and not put it down to Jerusalem.
But even so.
I'm curious in terms of the approach you use to reject the historical critical method. How do you counsel somebody against that particular method? What approach would you use to show one that the historical critical method is not valid? Do you do it strictly by looking at what scripture says about itself, or do you use kind of like an Albright approach?
I don't know that there's any one answer to that. I think it'd be a combination of things. Seems to me that what needs to be done is that you can't simply, ignore some of these carefully worked out models of critical sort to make whatever case is being made. But I think what we have to do is construct an alternative model that commends itself to set over against it. Not that you can necessarily disprove the critical model, but if you can show that there's a legitimate alternative to that that's based on reasonable and solid evidence, it seems to me that there needs to be a lot more work done of that sort. The Albright sort of thing, I think, has its place. I don't think it's necessarily going to be convincing, because somebody like T.L. Thompson or Van Cedars or somebody is just going to come up with an argument against the legitimacy of Albright's model. Well, then you have to go back and, try to establish that there is some legitimacy to it. I think it's just a combination of things like that, and also of looking at Scripture itself and presenting the claims of Scripture for what it itself represents itself to be. It's a basic issue. Of course, that's more a theological issue than it is an evidential kind of thing.
Do you feel that the areas where you have subjective revelation that you mentioned very early in the talk, does that eventually have to be confirmed by some sort of objective revelation? Or does the history of the prophet make the subjective revelation automatically sort of self-confirming?
Well, I think generally if you speak of the prophets, it depends on how you use that term, you speak of the prophets in the sense of the writers of the prophetic books, normally their messages involve that combination of word and confirmatory act. At least it's certain points that set their message in a certain context. It's not that you just believe this person because he claims to have had a divine revelation or some sort of authenticating sign or act or something that comes along with it. I mean, the two work together. It seems to me you meet this other more in the case of the Psalms. And it seems to me there you're talking about the issue of canon, I guess. Why were these things generally recognized and accepted as being scripture and the word of God? And it seems that they authenticated themselves as that in some way and came to be accepted as that. I don't know if you can say a whole lot more than that.